says, "Dear Lord, please help me to say whatever I'm going to say from my heart. And please help me make some contribution to this day." You know, once you got to AA, you wanted to tell everybody about it. And you can't until they're members of AA, and then you have the shared experience. And I wish I could share with you the experience that several of us in this room tonight have had today. And you can't. But today would not have been possible if it were not for my original home group of Cheshire, Connecticut on Tuesday night. And there are so many of them here, and so many of my dear friends from all over this place. When Don asked me or gave me this privilege, I think it was about a year ago, I don't know, I thought, you know, it would be like coming home from college the first time away to tell your mother and father how you did. Because my first 13 years in this fellowship were here in Connecticut. And I owe my life to that group in Cheshire, Connecticut. There were four of us, and we used to sit in little kindergarten chairs, and that's about just exactly how we felt. So, Don, really, thank you for the privilege.
Thank you.
I think I can thank you better later. Don't you like the way people assume and they always add something to what you say? I think it's very difficult to express gratitude and express feelings. But I'm darn sure there's so many of you in this room tonight so deeply grateful. So you kind of know how I feel. And why? Because I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is the Mount Group down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Though, as I said, Cheshire, Connecticut was my first home group, my first 13 years in the fellowship. And my name is Tommy Dayton.
Hi.
You know, when I got sober, we didn't do any of that. We didn't read how it works. We didn't hold hands. We didn't respond to each other. And yet here we are. We didn't drink. And it is incredible, once we make that commitment to not drink, the beautiful things that happen in our lives. Our stories disclose in a general way as what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. I always say I came from a dysfunctional family, but I'm it. Everybody else in my family was very average, very normal. You know, we hear so much criticism of those earth people, but if it weren't for them, we wouldn't know that our behavior was irresponsible. I'm the youngest of three daughters. My dad had the same job for 46 years. My mother was a homebody, a church organist. My family didn't smoke, they didn't drink. I quite often say I don't think they ever did anything that felt good. I don't know how I got here. But my parents were very private people, very caring, very loving people. No matter what I was involved in, they were always there. But they never shared their insides. We talked a lot about time and weather and other people, especially if they weren't there. But we didn't talk about, nobody talked about what was going on inside of them. And so I kept me a big secret for a long time, even after I came to you. I was very active in music. I was very active in sports. In fact, my first job, I played in an Earl Girls band, and I saw what was happening to people, so I didn't want it to happen to because of alcohol, and I didn't want it to happen to me, so I left the music profession, went into medical arts, and here I am. So it shows me I had absolutely nothing to do with my being an alcoholic. I had my first drink when I was a senior in high school. I didn't have that drink with the idea of becoming an alcoholic any more than I took a first pill ordered by a doctor in 1942. And in 1953, 54, I was withdrawing myself from morphine. I had that first drink in high school. And as I look back on it, and what I know about myself is all in retrospect, I sometimes have some foresight, mostly hindsight, but never any nowsight. So, you know, sometime along the road after tonight, I'll know what happened today, maybe. I don't know. I had that drink, and there was a signpost right that night, but everything is in total hindsight for me. I felt guilty just for having the drink. Didn't get drunk, nothing happened, except I remember I took that drink because I thought the young man with whom I was wanted me to have a drink. Never asked him. And when I think about it, from that time forward, no matter what anybody asked me to do, I would do it whether or not I wanted to do it for the sake of acceptance. So early on, I was not accepting of myself as a human being. Part of it was because I never heard anybody express anything about feelings. I grew up in Sunday school and church. Always said I believed in God because I thought I was supposed to. And the kind of God I had was in a church God. And apparently I always asked within my parents' means because I always seemed to get what I wanted. I had a sister who was very ill in 1945 with cancer. And in my inimitable style, I told God it was okay for her to die. And I didn't know until after I came to you folks that the only reason I wanted her to die was so I wouldn't have to worry about her. Self-centeredness. And I certainly identify with that right on down the line. So I walked away from that God. I remember trying to talk about feelings at some point. And this was after I was married, and I remember one night saying to my husband, I am so lonely. And he came back with a very logical response. I don't know why you're so lonely. You have these five beautiful children. You have a lovely home. You can do just about anything you want to do. I don't know why you're so lonely. Again, a very logical statement. So I wasn't going to talk to him anymore about how I was feeling. Gee. But now, again, in retrospect, I told alcohol. And alcohol said, have another drink and you'll feel better. And I did, and I did. And from that time on, until after I came to you folks, no matter what I did, how I felt, I drank to cover it up. I grew up in this family where nice girls didn't act out sexually, big girls didn't cry, and nice girls didn't get angry. And as my disease progressed, and you tell me it was a progressive illness, that I acted out in any one or all three of those areas very inappropriately, I might add. And I really learned that I had to learn how to do sober what I got drunk to do, or change my value system. The disease was progressive, and I used to think that you talked about its being progressive outside of me. I never lost a job from drinking. I wasn't working. I didn't drink with lower companions. I drank alone. And so I really believe all of our behaviors, we've all done it all. But we all come in and want to be such secrets. We're so ashamed, so full of remorse. But after I was sober for a while, I realized through you folks, and all I know today is what you have shared with me, just interpreted through my own thinking, that my illness is inside of me. And if you and I will talk about feelings, we can identify with each other. I don't know if this is yours or not, but I didn't care whose I drank when I got through it. And so when I talk about guilt and remorse, I think you know what I'm talking about. When I talk about resentments and what I call it Siamese twin self-pity, because I can't have one without the other, I think you know what I'm talking about. The loneliness, the aloneness. And I don't care what our outsides look like, and that's why I love Alcoholics Anonymous. When we talk about our insides, we all identify. So I don't care if we're short, tall, skinny, fat, male, female. I don't care what our outsides are like, but our insides touch. I can tell you the history of the progression of my behavior by my behavior in Cheshire, Connecticut. When I started out, I was a PTA member, and I was a hot lunch worker and a Girl Scout leader and a garden club member and women's club, and drove the station wagon for the Red Cross, all the things that mothers do in small towns. And in the course of my drinking, I became the drinking Girl Scout leader and the drinking motor car driver and eventually the drunken motor car driver and drunken Girl Scout leader. Try making hot lunch sandwiches, peanut butter sandwiches with a jelly sliding all over the place when you're drunk. It doesn't work. We make a lot of mistakes, so some of you don't have to do it. Don't be a hot lunch worker. That motor car driver for the Red Cross wasn't the charming one either. I used to, one of my responsibilities was to drive a lady who was literally blind to the grocery store. Of course, we were both blind, but me for different reasons. She always got to the counter first that had the can of green beans she wanted or the can of whatever she wanted. I would go around Cheshire singing or whistling at the top of my lungs so people would think I was happy, happy, happy. I had the same flannel dirty shirt on, the same filthy dungarees. My hair was up in pin curls. Now, some of you don't know what pin curls are. But I hadn't been invited anywhere for months, but I had to be ready. Something very important was going to happen, and I had to be ready. I've had two deliberate drunks in my life, hundreds of drunks, but only two deliberate ones. Once when I was a senior in college and we were going to New York for a tour of the hospitals, five of us decided that we would buy a pint and see what it was like to get drunk. Three of them backed out. So obviously there were two of us left, and I vowed I would never get drunk again. The other one, just before I came to you, my husband bought a hearse. Now, it was in the paranoia-like stage of my drinking. So you know what I thought he was going to do with it. I think we could say there's a bit of insanity, too, on our part. Because what is somebody going to do with a body in a hearse, you know? Well, we had the five children at the time. When I got sober, they were 6, 8, 10, 12, and 14. Now they're, I can't believe this, 55, 57, 61, and 63. But they were young, and we had a station wagon, and he said the hearse is 2 feet longer than a station wagon, so it will allow the children to grow. And And he said, and besides, if we're out on a camping trip and we can't find a place to park in a trailer camp, we can park along the side of the road. He said, you know, nobody's going to bother you in a hearse. Well, I was telling this story one night, and it occurred to me, what if somebody looked in and we all started moving? Awful. Well, I have to tell you, he drove this hearse to work the next morning. Now, this was to be our family car, our only car. You've heard of the family sickness. His uncle, with whom he was in business at the time, thought it was a little inappropriate for a doctor to be making house calls. You know, I don't think any of us wanted to be an alcoholic anything. Whether it was mother, wife, husband, daughter, sister, whatever. And nor did I. And I don't ever want to forget how I felt. And I feel you feel the same way, or you wouldn't be sitting in here tonight, not wanting to take the next drink. To experience the feelings again of guilt and remorse, of broken promises, the dread of facing the children or your spouse or partner or whatever. I never want to forget those feelings. I never want to forget walking past my mother and father drunk. People, parents who had been so kind to me, and I wanted so badly to be a daughter that they wanted, that they respected, I don't mean wanted. And I'll never forget that morning, the despair in which our disease takes us. I knew I couldn't walk past my mother and father because I was drunk. And I knew I had to. And I finally did. And I found myself saying, so what? And it was a loss of self-respect, and that's what really got me to you folks. I started going to psychiatrists a couple of years before I came to you. Went to the first of seven, find out what was the matter with the child they made me drink. Wasn't that real, though? The blaming that we did? And if I remember, I'll tell you why I think later on why I had to blame. First off, my emotional immaturity. You told me I had a physical allergy coupled with emotional immaturity and spiritual bankruptcy. Emotionally, I was 39 when I got here. I think I was about 10 emotionally. I was 87 last January. I think I might be about 21 now. My friends tell me maybe 25. I like that, so I think I'll keep coming. But I went to this first psychiatrist, and I defied him to tell me that I was an alcoholic. And he said, well, how much are you drinking? And I said, well, 3 or 4 a day. Well, he thought I was talking about highballs. I was talking about pints. I just didn't. And he said, of course you're not an alcoholic. And I loved him for that. Then I started to go to the clergyman and find out what was the matter with God, who wouldn't let me drink but keep me sober. And eventually the medical profession. And they couldn't find anything in the medical. I wanted some horrible terminal disease. I didn't know I had one, but I wanted one. And they couldn't find anything the matter with me. And I truly believe it's because our disease is threefold. This is what you shared with me. I didn't know that for a long, long time. I thought that the intoxication was the whole illness. And it wasn't until I lost faith in alcohol that I could come to believe that I was an alcoholic. Because that alcohol had become a power greater than myself. In 1960, you know, I forgot what time I started. Somebody's going to have to remind me. I don't know. You don't know either? Oh, well, too bad. You're here for the night. My drinking, my speaking is like my drinking. Once I get started, I can't stop. In 1960, I was in the Waterbury Hospital for, well, they called it malnutrition and dehydration because I had stopped eating 6 months before that because it was the food that made me sick. And that was so real to me. It was so real that it was the food that made me sick because alcohol was still doing something for me. And so I lost the 50 pounds, and I was in the hospital in a room with a lady who had been injured in a horseback riding accident. And she'd had fractured ribs and abrasions, but I was discharged on a Saturday morning, and she was to be discharged the following Monday. And I got home that afternoon, and I had such a need to get back to that hospital. Charlie was on staff there, and he said, "Why do you have to go back?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I don't know, but it's got to be the same bed." He took me back, and that night, I've had shock treatments after that, so I don't remember this specifically, but I've been told some of the details. And I felt that this lady was very ill, and I called the nurse and told her, and she said, "Oh, she's fine, go back to bed," and I couldn't do that. And I called her husband, and I called her doctor, and they came in, and I don't know, 5 or 6 hours later, her doctor came to me, and he said, "Mrs. Dayton, you saved this woman's life." She'd had a ruptured spleen and was bleeding internally. Now, prior to that, that lady died just a couple years ago at 94, and she always gave me credit for her life. I always gave her credit for my life because I couldn't say the word God. I was so mad at God when he wouldn't take my sister when I was so emotionally immature. And because of this experience, I came to believe there must be something to this God business. But I said, "The man upstairs." I couldn't say the word God. My cheeks seemed to sink in or something. I don't know what was going on. So I thought, "Tommy, you better stop drinking." I had tried to stop before. You know what we do. We promise. We make a vow for tomorrow. And I truly meant it every time I said it, and it never would work because I'd never decided to not take the next drink. I didn't take a drink for 3 months or so, and we were having a dinner party at Waverly Inn one night. And when you come from Cheshire, you've either been put into the reformatory or kicked out of the academy or drunk at Waverly Inn. I didn't qualify for the reformatory and I didn't qualify for the academy, but yeah, I've been drunk at Waverly Inn. But that night, as my dinner was served me, I ordered one Manhattan. I thought, you know that reward system, you've been a good kid, you deserve a drink. So I ordered one Manhattan, not during the cocktail hour, but as my dinner was served me. And that drink lasted me. You talk about progression. There was then no stopping me. I couldn't stop for, another month or two. And I was taken up to St. Francis Psychiatric Hospital in Hartford, where I had what they call sleep therapy, as shock treatments with anesthesia. Was there for 2 weeks, came home in a blackout, drove with two of our children when they were just little babies, 35 miles from home, came out of a blackout, called Charlie, begged him to take me back to the hospital. I didn't want to go back because I knew it meant more shock treatments, but that's how desperate we can get. And I don't want to forget that despair, the desperation that we feel, that we have to get to, I believe. And back I went for 2 more weeks of the treatment and then home again. I didn't know what to do with my resentments. This was all his fault. He should have been up there anyhow, having them. And you know that thinking. It's incredible what we blame our families for. And I came home, and on the 4th of November 1960, alcohol forsook me. It just didn't do anything for me anymore. And I truly believe that that's why I couldn't believe that I was an alcoholic. When any of the women tell me they're not an alcoholic, I believe them. Because I certainly believed that I was an alcoholic until I lost faith in alcohol. Dr. Harry Thibault, an old-time friend of AA, non-alcoholic, always used to talk about that harsh voice of reality when we there is no belief system, and that's pain. And we all know that. And I took an overdose of sleeping capsules because I chose to take my life. The God of my understanding that I've come to know through you sharing your God with me saw fit the night I wanted to take my life that I should live. And when I came to the next morning, I heard me cry out loud, "My God, I can't even kill myself. What do I do? What do I do?" I had tried God, I tried the medical profession, I tried psychiatrist. Nothing was working. And I thought, "My God, Tommy, you're an alcoholic. That's what this has all been about." And you know that first freedom before all the ick starts in recovery. And I mean everything that starts coming up from the inside. And I asked my husband to please call a lady I knew was in the fellowship. And she suggested that I go up to High Watch Farm, and I shall be eternally grateful. High Watch was then an AA-only oriented facility, and we used to stay there for a week. And I'm not going to give my opinion, but that was what was right for me. I truly somehow believe that no matter where we are, when we make that commitment, the knowledge that we're an alcoholic, and are given that gift of the one requirement of AA, a desire to be sober, that's where our bottoms are, and it can be anywhere. Mine happened to be High Watch, and I am so grateful. The fourth day that I was up there, we used to have about a 10-minute little time in the chapel room, and Wes ended up that morning with four words, "Let go and let God." And I believe that morning I did, momentarily. And there was a picture of a young man in prayer fashion up on the wall looking up to the heavens, and there was a light that lit around his head. And I had a weight on my right shoulder that I truly believe was the physical hand of God. And I am eternally grateful for that. I had never had that kind of experience before, other than this spiritual experience in the hospital. After a week, I came home, and Wes said to me, "Now go home and find yourself a group." That was easy. Cheshire had one group at the time. Find yourself a sponsor. That was easy. There was one female in the group. I said, "How many meetings should I go to?" He said, "One more than you need." "Should I go every day? Did you drink every day?" You folks never answered a question. It was awful because in my upbringing, I don't think anybody ever said this, but if I made a mistake, it would mean I was a failure. And I was so afraid to make decisions because what if it was a wrong one? It would have meant I was bad and a failure. And I've come to know through you folks sharing yourselves with me that mistakes are just become my experience. And what a gift that is. So I came home from High Watch, and boy, did I get busy in AA. Oh, my goodness. A great Messiah arrived when I got here. And I was going to sober up the world. I don't know what happened. A couple months later in January, it was my birthday, and I don't know why I had to drink that day. Didn't get drunk. And then came Valentine's Day, 1961. Now, I was 5 days off my last drink. Not drunk. Drink. And Charlie didn't give me a Valentine. And besides, he gave me a cookie sheet, and I didn't think that was very romantic, so I grabbed it. Well, 5 days off a drink, he should have at least given out the red carpet. You know, that's a long time to not have a drink. So I drank at him. Nothing happened except progression, guilt, and remorse like I have never had before or since. And that's really part of what has kept me from not drinking. 9 months later, I would have picked up a drink if I could have blamed him. But something happened that night at a dinner, High Watch dinner dance in New York. And somebody said something. Don't you like that something happened? And I don't know what it was, but I thought, Tommy, if you ever take a drink or for me a few other things again, you have nobody or nothing to blame but yourself. I went up to my then sponsor's home and that Valentine's Day. It was a Tuesday. And I said, how am I going to have the right change? Oh, these are very World III war decisions. How am I going to have the right change for the paper boy on Saturday? I have 5 kids. How am I going to get 5 quarters out for Sunday school for next Sunday? How do you cook turkey for Thanksgiving without a drink? How do you Christmas shop without a drink? And how in the world am I going to have my first anniversary next February 14th without a drink? I can still hear her pounding her fist on her kitchen table, and she said, for God's sakes, Tommy, it's only Tuesday. Would you please use it up first? Now, I don't know about you. I was good at living a day at a time, but it's never the right day. Never. But from that experience, I made a commitment. I will not drink, no matter what. Took the worst scenario that I could think of. And I truly believe without that commitment to drink, if we're not sick and tired of being sick and tired, we can almost guarantee we will drink again. And if there are any of you here tonight who are at that crossroads, this is a pretty safe place with all so many alcoholics who have had to do the same thing. I would urge you to try to make that commitment here while you're here. Talk to somebody about it. Because it's so important for us. We have a terminal illness, and if we drink, it is to die. I don't know about you, but I never, never, never want to feel again the way I felt coming off of that last drink. I was sober a year, and I met my to-become sponsor, and she was Hazel Rice, who used to work in general service office. And Hazel spoke at a spiritual panel at Banner Lodge when we were first at Banner Lodge many years ago, 1962, I think it was. And she said, while she was during her talk sharing, she said, let us keep not only an open mind, but also an open heart. And the tears, the flood came. I wasn't crying, but the tears were streaming down my face. And I realized I had a closed heart for so long out of hatred and judging of my own behavior. And I often think when we give ourselves such a tough time emotionally, are we not living in the past over the behavior or lack of it? And I truly believe that if we are so upset about our past and feel so bad about it, we're not the bad people that we think we are. We wouldn't think of ourselves as being bad if we accepted it. So give yourselves a break, okay? It's all the past out of irresponsible behavior as a result of our drinking. So it became important for me to start to implement these steps inside of me. Now, I had the privilege of sponsoring some of the gals when I first got sober, and some of them weren't staying sober. I mean, didn't they know who they asked, you know? And by this time, I'd already come to know Bill. So I went bellyaching, if you will, to Bill and told him these ladies weren't staying sober. And he said, Tommy, do you think I'd 12-step Dr. Bob so he wouldn't drink? I said, sure. Didn't you think when you came in you were here to sober up the world? He said, oh, no. I said, sure, Bill. He said, oh, no. I 12-step Dr. Bob so I wouldn't drink. So he said, in essence, though he said it very nicely and gently, when you think you know what somebody else needs to hear, that's only because your only head needs to hear it. You don't know what somebody else's head needs to hear. I used to think you could hear what I was thinking, but I couldn't hear it. He said, you have to get your own thoughts out that you think somebody else needs to hear. I don't always know what I know is right for me. How do I know what's right for somebody else? And I thought, from that moment on, I realized that's why we sponsor, to discover ourselves. People say, oh, you do so much, you help so many people. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't help anybody. I share my experience, strength, and hope. And when somebody else is hurt and bad enough and willing to listen, they allow themselves to be helped. It isn't because we say it. I truly believe it takes one person saying it and one person listening. So in this room tonight, there's you and there's me. However many of us there are, it's just the two of us. That's incredible to me. I wonder why it is. I don't know how many are here registered, 1,100 and something, you said, that it's us and not 1,100 other people. Where were you when you had your first drink of your last drunk? Did you take that drink with the idea of being here tonight? I sure didn't. Some power greater than myself is working in my life. And I'm ever so grateful to be here. I believe I had to lose faith in alcohol before I could find another power greater than myself. I cannot serve two powers at one time. And once I lost my need to define God, I found God. It's a power within me that allows me to do appropriately what I got drunk to do. That's an awesome gift for me. In 1966, Abby Thatcher died. Now, Abby was Bill's sponsor, and Bill wanted you to know that, and he also wanted you to know that Abby died sober with 2.5 years. Abby died in Albany, and some of us went up on the East Coast, Bill and Lois and my sponsor and myself. By the way, sponsors teach us how to live. My sponsor taught me how to die. She died in my arms just 31 years ago yesterday. What an incredible experience that was. So 12 of us went out to Albany and went to Abby's funeral. Can you believe that? 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts, 12 people at Abby's funeral. When I was on the way up to Albany with my sponsor, and when you're in your car with your sponsor, things happen. My fourth step poured out of me. And I think we all get rid of the immoral inventory. But I didn't know what a moral inventory was until I was sober about 5 years. This was in 1966. And my fifth step inventory poured out of me. I was standing with Bill at Abby's casket with our arms around each other, and I said, you know, because Bill never stopped 12-stepping Abby, like I owe my life to the ladies, I have the privilege of sponsoring them, and some of them are here tonight, and I am so deeply grateful for you ladies. Bill never stopped 12-stepping Abby, and in trying to help Abby, Bill discovered himself. And isn't what Bill did in the Mayflower, he knew he had to reach for an alcoholic. Didn't you also know that when you came to believe that desperation, that you needed to reach an alcoholic and you called AA? It's incredible to me. But when Bill got here, he didn't have a coffee cup, he didn't have a booklet, he didn't have a pamphlet, but he had that desire to stop, not drink. And that's when we hit our bottoms, I truly believe. When we were standing at Abby's casket, and I said to Bill, who was to say, if Abby had been given the grace to stay sober, that you would have? He said, Tommy, I thought of that so many times. Coming home from Albany to Connecticut, the third step took me. And it was the God of my understanding, whom I've come to know through your sharing your God with me. Tommy, when you wake up in the morning, the day's already born. Your only responsibility is to see where you fit into the day. I don't know about you, but I used to come to and start manipulating the day to fit my wants. I don't do that anymore. That doesn't mean I'm not self-centered and have some of the old traits that I used to have. Back in 1989, I really have no idea when I started. Can I have 10 more minutes? 10 minutes maybe? Just 10 minutes. Where were you when I was drinking? 10 minutes, he said. Back in 89, my daughter Barbara was to be diagnosed with a biopsy for breast cancer. And I was in Florida, and she was in California. So in my inimitable style, I got on an airplane to go to California to be with my daughter. And I had a little, I'm a terrible tradition prude, and I had a little book that I thought maybe some AA-er had made some money on, so I wasn't going to read it. Well, it was a little book that fit into my pocketbook, and I'm sitting on this airplane absolutely petrified. I had, 19 or something years of sobriety at the time. And I was thinking about Barb and thinking about my role. I was planning her casket, her funeral even. She hadn't even had the biopsy, for heaven's sake. And I was reading this little book, and somewhere it was underlined, "Get God-centered." I couldn't do it for about that long, and then I was right back into self-centered, absolutely scared to death, back to God-centered, back to self-centered. And all of a sudden, one of you came to my mind and said, "Hey, Tommy, what about Barbara? What is she thinking? What is she feeling?" I went out there. It was malignant. She had mastectomy and did very well for about 10, 12 years. And then it returned, and that was 7 years ago. I am telling you this just to let you know that I can still deviate back to who I used to be like. I didn't come this way, somebody said. And 7 years ago, her cancer returned. And she used to say to me, "Mom, you can come out, but I want visits. I don't want vigils." I like that. But you have taught me so about growing emotionally and spiritually away from the need for a drink that I was able to listen to my daughter. And she said at the last end of her life, "You can come out for 2 days." Well, I said, okay. So I went out there for 2 days. And when she was at the terminal stage of her life, and this is through you folks giving me the support I needed at the time, I left. And I knew, I said, "Go in peace, honey." And I came home here, and it was the Connecticut Convention. It was 5 years ago on Tuesday, the 8th. And when it was a Thursday at the time, and I came here and came to this convention immediately after being with my own other four children, and you were here. Now, this is the support that we give each other. It is an incredible thing because we come to believe in another power greater than ourselves, God as I understand him. And I truly believe we find that. I think that's what the principles of these steps are about. I hear these single words for principles. You won't find that in AA literature anywhere. The steps are the principles, in my opinion. That's what the 12th step tells me. But the first step tells me about the physical part of my illness. The second step tells me about the emotional immaturity of my illness. The third step tells me about the spiritual malady that I have. Now that I've described the illness, I have to find its symptoms that I find in the fourth inventory step. And then I tell you and God and me about those symptoms. Now that I've discovered that, I've got to start doing something about it. Am I entirely ready to let God do that? I truly believe God's not going to do it unless I get willing. I'm the alcoholic. God isn't. And he gave me free will. So I have to become entirely ready. And then when I am entirely ready, God will is there to do it. And then I have to humbly ask him in the seventh step. The eighth step, we've already made our list in our fourth step. In the ninth, we make the amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Now we're complete in exposing ourselves. But then we have some life to live, absolute to live life. So we continue to take personal inventory, and when wrong, promptly admit it. Just recently, this last month or so, I've made amends to each of my children again. Because I realized I made amends when I first got sober, and I make amends along the way. But I've truly been sorry for some of the things that I did or didn't do. And I think there were plenty of things like that that as a mother I did that needed or didn't do that needed to be examined again because I'm trying to change. It's not about forgiveness. It's about making amends. To me, that's what amend means. And then there's the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will. It doesn't say praying for His will. Praying for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in our affairs. Isn't that finding a new God of our understanding? That's the purpose to me of the 12 steps. But I still have my inventory to take. I'm a mother. I have these four beautiful children today, adults. My son just retired at 54. He has 33 years without a drink. Barb died at 54 with 12 years. Two of my daughters have lost three children. Two of them have had tragic accidents with husbands. My husband chose to live his life with another family. My sponsor died in my arms. Four of my daughters are college graduates. Some of them have been married more than once. That didn't get me drunk. It's the alcohol that I drink that gets me drunk. But you know what I really believe is why I'm not drinking today? Alcohol. I do a lot of drinking. I mean, I just picked up a glass. You know, that's drinking. I found a power greater than myself that allows me to feel appropriately for what's going on in my life. You better believe when Barb was so ill and died, we had hug circles and cried together. What gifts? What gifts? I've been there for my children. They've been there for me. I could go on, but I have this way I take my inventory. Through God's grace, I have these wonderful children. I'm a grandmother. I'm great-grandmother by 9 kids. This is incredible. And they all call me Gigi. They all know me. This is what this fellowship does for us, because our children want their children to know us. I'm an AA member. Through God's grace, I have many friends, so I am a friend. And I take my inventory this way. Am I the kind of mother I would like to have? Am I the kind of grandmother, great-grandmother? What kind of an AA member am I? Am I the kind of friend I would like to have? When the answer is no, it's time for me to check inside of me and see where I've slipped right back into the self-centeredness, self-involvement, wanting control, all that I did when I was an active alcoholic. And is this not just getting out of our own way and letting the grace of God within work without? I truly believe it is. I really think what this program is about is our attitude. It's a disease of the attitudes. And I didn't know what you're talking about till one day one of you said, today I'm not behind in my earning, I'm just ahead in my washing. It sums it up so beautifully. I want to close with a little prayer, pray for you often. I certainly want to thank Don and the committee for giving me this privilege. I want to tell you two quickie 12-step things. We didn't, 12-step experiences. 12-stepping was a lot different than it used to, than it is today, though it's as important how we 12-step today, too, in different ways. There's so many different ways. When I was still living here in Cheshire, we had a gal who was going from New Haven to Chicago by bus, and she was absolutely petrified. So we got her bus schedule, and we got a world directory. In those days, we only had one world directory. And at every stop that bus made along the route from New Haven to Chicago, there was an AA arm with a cup of coffee on it for her. That's 12-step work. The other one, and I could go on and tell you my privileges with Bill and Lois, but the last one that I had with Bill, not counting the one we all had with him in Miami, just about 13 seconds, 19 maybe, Lois had invited us to lunch at her home, and when I drove in the driveway, it was February of 1970, and when we drove in the driveway, it was snowing. It was a beautiful snowy day, and Bill came running up the steps in his shirt sleeves, and I said, Bill, what are you doing and running up the steps? He said, I quit smoking. I should have done 9 years ago, but at least I quit. So we get in the house, and any of you who have been to Stepping Stones, or those of you who haven't, please get there when you can, or to Dr. Bob's home or the Wilson House up in East Dorset. When you walk in the Stepping Stones, you walk in, on your left is a beautiful fireplace, and Bill had a roaring fire in the fireplace that day. Then the living room furniture that had included a coffee table, and then a couch looking into the fireplace. And over in your far right is a dining room table. And Lois was on one end when we were having lunch, and then my sponsor, Hazel, and then I, and then Bill on this end, and a lady who she remained nameless was sitting across from me. And she was having a very difficult time with depression. And she excused herself and got up and went over and laid down on the couch so that we couldn't see her, but she was looking into the fireplace. Now, Bill loved crowds. There's no question about that. But Bill couldn't stand it when he knew there was an alcoholic suffering. The one-on-ones he had meant more to him than the big crowds that he loved, really loved. And he excused himself. I don't think a minute went by. And he excused himself and got up and went over and sat on the coffee table so we could see him looking down on her, 12-stepping her. You know, when you first get sober, you think, what'll I ever do when I stop drinking? There won't be anything to do. That, to me, is the highlight of all the privileges that I've had. Watching Bill Wilson, 12-step, a fellow alcoholic. This has come to me through God's grace, working through you people. How could I ever thank you and the Cheshire Group and all the friends who are here tonight? I cannot thank you enough from the very bottom of my heart. And I would like to close with a little prayer that I pray very often. But first, may I say, I believe the key to my sobriety is the two words, I believe, and people. And to me, people are like the seeds of a flower. They need the miracle of God and man to make them grow. And to me, that is AA, the miracle of God and man. Dear Lord, please help me to accept the kind of life you have chosen for me to live. Make me ever mindful of the needs of others and what you would have me do with my life, that thy will be done. Thank you very much, and I love you.